I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hi, everyone. My name's Sophie Black. I'm the Head of Special Projects at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. And on behalf of the Sydney Writers Festival, I'd like to welcome you to this very intimate chat with Judy Bloom. Well, us and 63 libraries and venues around the country that we're also live streaming to. Now, before we start, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present. Sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Now, we all have a lot of feelings about Judy Bloom. I can feel them. I can sense them tingling in the room. I think her books carry the emotional weight of the age we were when we read them, when we were either burning with embarrassment or curiosity or all of it mashed in together. And for kids today, those books are just as relevant as ever. Bloom's body of work, spanning children's, young adults, and adult fiction, exceeds some 85 million in sales. And as one of the most frequently banned authors in America, she's also a fierce anti-censorship advocate. On the side, she now runs a bookshop in Key West, Florida, from where she comes to us now. So everyone, please take a collective deep breath. Join me in going crazy for Judy Bloom. Hi, Judy. I don't know if you can hear that wild applause, but it is very wild.
I do.
You can. Good. I'm so glad.
Thank you.
It's so lovely to see you. I wanted to ask open with a slightly weird question. Is it true that you like to sniff books?
I have always liked to sniff books, yes.
Yeah.
They don't smell the way they did when I was a little kid, but I still sniff them, yes.
The reason I ask is because I have a copy, one of my many paperbacks of yours, and this is from 1983. This is starring Sally J. Friedman as herself. And I have been inhaling it in anticipation of talking to you because I find the smell a combination of very thrilling and very comforting. And I think it's because it brings back all the memories and the feelings that I felt when I first read you. And I think that feeling is what we now call a term that we now use, which is feeling seen. And I think a lot of people in this room feel the same way. How do you deal with that kind of level of importance that's attributed to your work? How do you deal with people like us who feel so emotional to meet with you?
I don't think of it that way, ever. I mean, I'm always thrilled to meet people who read my books. And, you know, we have cry fests at the bookstore. and it's emotional for me, too. But you know, I don't think of myself that way or my books that way. I just don't.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, a person, and this is what I was able to do. I didn't even know what I was doing. So
I've read that you have said before that everybody has an age at which they are fixed, a sort of an internal age that represents them and everything that they are. What's your internal age?
Well, actually, it was Sir Stephen Spender. I think I read that he said that, and then I then used it and attributed it to him, but now people think I said it first. But anyway, I think we do have that. And I can be anywhere from 4 to, I don't know, my husband's here, I should ask him. 12, he says 12. I identify with certain ages, I guess. And yeah, I mean, I can be this woman that I am, but I'm also the girl that I always was. We all are.
Who was that girl? Paint a picture of that girl for us.
That girl started out shy and quiet and changed at around age 10 to being much more outgoing. But I think inside, you know, the shy, quiet person doesn't go away. It's just that something else comes out. And I was a creative kid. I made up stories always inside my head. I never wrote them down. I never shared them with anyone, but they were there almost as far back as I can remember. My play was very much, you know, I like to have something in my hand, a paper doll that I made, you know, some real, I had a set of cards, greeting cards that I like that had children on them, and I made them into my classroom, and I gave pretend piano lessons. I kept the notebook for each of my pretend students and how they were doing, and then I would play in that style that I thought, you know, it could be terrible. It could be as good as I could be, which wasn't that good. But always had that inner life, that really, really strong inner life that I never shared. I never shared that with anyone.
So you didn't start sharing those stories, or at least writing them down, until you were a mother, a young mum in your 20s. What was it about that experience that drove you to finally start writing?
I think it was the desperation. I mean, it sounds funny, but I needed desperately the creative outlet that I had had all the time I was in school. And suddenly I didn't have it. You know, I loved taking care of little kids. I still like little kids. But I needed that something else. And you know, I didn't start with writing. I started making felt pictures. They were made out of felt. That's why I call them felt pictures. And I packed them in a suitcase one day, and I got on a bus and I took them to Bloomingdale's in New York. I lived in suburban New Jersey. And I don't know where I got the nerve to do this. I didn't know any better. And I got to Bloomingdale's and somebody said to me, oh, you need to see the buyer of children's accessories. And it was like, oh, yes, I need to see the buyer of children's accessories. And they took me up to this person, and I opened the suitcase and I took out these pictures that I had made. I had, I think, three samples. And he said, yes, we'll take that one in red and we'll take that one in pink. And he chose two. And they were going to be special orders, and I was going to be paid $9 for each one. They were sold for $18. And I was so, so excited. I was in business. I had creative work, and I did that for, I don't know, a couple of years. And then, you know, the Elmer's glue started to get to my fingers and itchy, made them itchy, and I had to find something else. And really, I think I always loved to read. And I was reading my kids' picture books all the time in those days, and rhyming picture books. And I started writing rhyming picture books that were pretty bad. Nevertheless, I sent them in to publishers. I illustrated them myself. I have very little talent. I hate to say no talent in illustrating, but, you know, I did it. And they were rejected. And then I said, you know, I really like to read novels. I really like to read longer books. And then I took an omen came to my house one day. It was an announcement that New York University was giving a class in writing for children through tweens, maybe through teens, I don't know. And I said, this is an omen, and I have to do this. And once a week, I took that class. I went into New York, again on the bus, and it was an evening class, and it changed my life. You know, nobody can teach you to write, but being in an atmosphere where you're not the only one, and we had a very supportive teacher. She had rules and regulations, you know, children can never overhear things and children have to do this and that and everything has to be tied up neatly at the end. And I didn't pay attention to any of that. But she remained supportive always. And I tell people who take classes, you know, that's what you want. You want a supportive leader, a supportive teacher. If you're in a writing group, you want a supportive group. And that's when I started selling my first stories and then book.
Is it true that Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, poured out of you in 6 weeks? Is that right?
I think so. A first draft, I think so. It was my third published book, but it was the first book where I let go and I said, okay, you know, I've written these other two books. They weren't from the heart, from the gut. But I kind of know how to do this now. And now I'm just going to forget all the rules and just write what was true. It was my truth. It was my reality, you know. But it did pour out very quickly. Huh, what a joke. I can't do anything like that. It's been years since I could do anything like that. You know, you're lucky when it's, everything is fresh and new and spontaneous, because that's probably when you do your best work.
Mm. And those years were prolific. I believe that you wrote between 70 and 77, you published Blubber, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, Then Again Maybe I Won't, and starring Sally J. Friedman as herself. Why do you think it poured out of you in the way that it did? Was it that act of remembering? What was it that just spurred you to just get it all on the page?
Well, I mean, it did change my life. Mm. I wasn't happy. I wasn't, I needed something. Yeah. And I didn't know what I needed. I couldn't have told you then, oh, Judy, what you need is this. But I felt it. And so, I mean, when I finished Margaret and I sent it off, I didn't know if it would be published, but I sent it to the same editor who bought Iggy's House. And many, many, many years later, Dick Jackson, who was just the most wonderful editor anyone could ever have. And years later, I said to him, Dick, what did you ever see in Iggy's House? And he said, I saw the next book and the book after that and the book after that. And so when I sent Margaret off, I sat down the next day at the kitchen table. I think I was typing at my kitchen table then on a little, my college electric typewriter. And I started Then Again, Maybe I Won't. I thought, well, you know, I was a girl. I was this 12-year-old girl for whatever. It wasn't 6 months, 6 weeks. It was more like 6 months by the time everything was finished. And now I think what I'd like to be is a 12-year-old boy. And so that's how I wrote Then Again, Maybe I Won't. I don't know. It's so odd to think back to it now.
Often being in the trenches of motherhood with young kids is not always associated with fueling creativity as well. Just to find the time, to carve out the time to write. But it sounds like it kept you sane. Were you inspired by your kids as well? Did that help your incredible recall of that experience of childhood?
Eventually, yes. By the time I wrote Blubber, but let me just say that what I did in those days, which I certainly don't do anymore, is I really made use of those 2 hours every morning that they were in preschool. Yeah. I really use my time well. I haven't done that in years. Use my time well. And I used to think, oh, as they get older, you know, or as they grow up, I'm going to have more and more time for writing, and won't that be wonderful? And it doesn't always turn out that way. But, you know, they were sick a lot. I was sick a lot. I can remember winters when it was just, oh, just the three of us home so sick month after month and just waiting for spring. And probably that's why I live where I live now in Key West, because I've always loved summer and it's summer all the time.
Iggy's House, which you mentioned, I mean, that was one of the very first books to be marketed to children around tackling racism and prejudice. And that is a very big subject to tackle for a first-ish book. Similarly, Margaret tackles, you know, periods and bras and religion. So all the things you should never talk about at a dinner party. Were you aware of how politically charged some of this work was or could be interpreted as?
No, I don't think so. I didn't know anything. You know, I didn't know anybody who wrote. I didn't know anybody who had ever written. I didn't have a writer's group the way people do today, and I think that's great that they do. I didn't have Society of Children's Book Writers, which we have today. It was just me alone, and I lived inside those characters and books, and I keep saying this, but it's true. It changed my life. Maybe it saved my life. I don't know. I don't know what would have happened. I was trained to teach second grade. I never got into the classroom to do that because I had kids right away. And I don't know if I'd have been any good. I have no idea.
I have a feeling you'd be pretty good, actually. back to Margaret, rereading that book, it's really astounding to keep remembering that it was written 50 years ago. It's just, wow. That immediate voice, that immediate inner voice and that inner conversation with God, I just want to read two lines where Margaret says, "I knew what the weather was like the second I got up. I knew because I caught my mother sniffing under her arms. She always does that when it's hot and humid to make sure her deodorant's working. I don't use deodorant yet. I don't think people start to smell bad until they're at least 12. So I've got a few months to go." So many of your books centre around bodies, sort of these bodies that crave or ooze or break out in rashes or refuse to start blossoming into puberty. What drew you to writing about bodies in the way that you do?
If only I could answer that question. I guess that, well, I mean, like Margaret, I was certainly obsessed for a year in my life with breast development. I wanted it desperately. It didn't happen for me. I'm still waiting. And getting my period because a lot of my friends already did. And I lied. I lied to them in sixth grade. And I told them that I did get it. Mm-hmm. I even wore pads to school so that if they could feel, you know, through my skirt or my pants, whatever we wore, that I too had pads. And you know that I just came back from a week of being on the set of the Margaret movie. I don't know if you want to jump to that, but and the scene where I sat there and watched this scene between the two girls, one who has lied, not Margaret, but her friend Nancy has lied and said, "I got my period." And Margaret has no reason to doubt it. And then they are in a restroom together in a restaurant with Nancy's family. And Nancy goes into the stall and gets her first period. And Margaret has to run and get her mother and finds out that Nancy has lied to her. And that kind of changes the relationship. You know, is she really my friend? Isn't she my friend? She's a bit of a pushy, not a bully so much, but pushy. And here she is crying in the stall, quite hysterically. And Margaret says to Nancy's mother, does she always act like this when she gets her period? And Nancy's mother said, it's her first time, dear. She's a little frightened. Oh, that scene, watching that being filmed, that was so, I mean, that was the scene that really got to me, you know, because it was so, it was a wonderful scene. And just, I thought that the two young actors playing Margaret and Nancy were so good, but I loved it. I just loved it.
It must be such a treat to see your work coming to life in that way. Again, sorry to say it, but 50 years later, it's quite extraordinary. You are so good at writing about female friendship and kid friendship, which is so intense. But on reflection, you realise as an adult that kids don't really talk to each other, do they? They don't tell each other much.
Oh, I think they do.
You think they do?
Oh, I think some of them do. Yeah, I think some of them do. I don't know. I mean, I have a best friend, and she has been my best friend since seventh grade. And when I think back, we pretended a lot that everything was fine, and it wasn't. And we didn't confide in one another. But I think a lot of kids do. I hope they do. Yeah. I think they feel safe doing that.
You have a very, the way that you write about kids' relationships and kids is very, what's the word? Sort of unapologetic. It doesn't pull any punches. So you mentioned Blubber earlier. For example, Jill in Blubber, the protagonist, she can be very hard to read in some ways. She's not entirely a sympathetic character. In a way, she's a little unrepentant by the end. There's no real resolution between her and Linda. And the whole thing is, like, rereading it as an adult, it's so matter of fact, which of course kids can be. You don't often tie your books into a neat bow. You referred to that before, you broke all your teacher's rules. How deliberate was that to not provide that resolution in so many of your books?
Well, I think in Blubber, which is a book I'm very proud of, in Blubber, it was certainly deliberate. I was not going to tie it up. And so often the child that's been bullied, given the chance, this was then, may not be true now because we're talking about it a lot more, but then the child who was bullied might turn right around and, given the chance, become a bully. And I think that's what happened with Linda. And Jill sees it. She's observant, but, you know, life goes on and she chooses another friend. She chooses the quiet girl who was sitting in the back just watching all of this happen. And I hope that Jill and Rochelle, I think that's her name, go on to become real friends. That's what I hope. While I don't tie things up neatly, I'm an optimist, and I have always felt that I like to end my books on an optimistic outlook.
You also speak very uncondescendingly. Is that a word? I'm going to say that it's a word. To kids' concerns. So whether it's masturbation in Deanie or periods and bras in Margaret or sex and birth control in Forever or death in Tiger Eyes, how do you retain that skill as an author of never, ever talking down?
You know the answer. You know it's I don't know.
You don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I think all of us who write, we go into some other place. When it's going well, you're not aware of it. And, you know, a few hours go by and you read it and you say, how did I do that? Yeah. How did I even know that? I don't know that I know that. And that's on a really, really good day.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it comes from some other part of our brain.
Yeah.
And we go into this special place, not that special place that Deanie went into, but anyway, but you know,
whatever
we go into a different, we go into a different part of our head, and we're not aware of how this is happening. You know, there are some things I could tell you. I could tell you that with Blubber, I made a very careful calendar. It takes place in a month, I think. And I knew on every day, you know, I would track it, what was happening. And sometimes it happens and then you go back and put it in. Okay, that happens there. So then this has to happen here. But I don't know. I'm not an outliner when I'm writing
yeah.
a novel. Of course, there are lots and lots of mini outlines within, you know, the work, but I don't outline in the way that some people do. Whatever works for you as a writer, you know, there are no rules. So, with Blubber, I remember that. And you know, that when I say that my kids were an inspiration for that book, it's because they were then in that age group and they were writing the school book, the school bus every day. And I wanted to write a book about the school bus culture. You know, I didn't know what it was going to be, but what goes on that school bus. And, you know, a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff. There's a lot of dark stuff in many of your books. You don't shy away from that. For example, Sally J. Friedman is constantly dreaming up stories about Hitler. And given that it's set in World War II and she's consumed with, or in the wake of World War II, and she's consumed with Hitler as this villain, and he's the protagonist in all of her stories, and she's constantly dreaming up stories in which he's turning friends into lampshades and all sorts of very macabre things. Do you think it's important not to shy away from darkness for kids?
Sally J. Friedman is my most autobiographical book. So Sally is very much the kind of child I was. You know, not everything really happened in that book, but of course. But I had very dark stories going around in my head. Yeah, I mean, that was it. And the whole reason I wrote the book was because a teacher wrote to me and said, I'm doing a study on creativity, and I'm a fifth grade teacher. And so I'm writing to people and asking them, you know, to tell me what they were like as children. And that really sent me into Sally Friedman's life and writing that story. Yeah, I like Sally. I want Sally to be a musical on stage. That's a fantasy I have.
Well, I don't know. Now that you've got a movie under your belt, or you nearly do, maybe that's the next thing. There's a newish cover of Are You There, God, Margaret, which depicts her question as a text message. It's quite clever, and it has God replying with those three little thinking dots. It's a really clever cover, but it is
looks
a reminder.
Like,
oh, there we go. That's it.
Looks like that.
It's really, really clever.
You know, it's very funny. And, you know, the publisher, I was in the publisher's office, and they were recovering all the books. And they showed me that, and they said, oh, you know, please, if you hate it, of course we won't use it. And I thought, what you just said, I mean, it's clever. It's so clever. It seems to be okay. You know, people like it.
It's a reminder of how different the world is for kids, though, these days, isn't it? I mean, do you think Margaret's life would be, or her inner life would be, any different if she'd been born today, in that kids communicate with each other and the world so differently now?
They do. I mean, electronics has changed everything. But I think inside, I think people are still the same. I don't, you know, the electronics that we have changes how we communicate. But what are people feeling inside? I don't know. I'm not an expert, but I think it's the same. I think, you know, my mother's generation felt things inside, love, hate, jealousy, all of the feelings. And my generation and my kids and my grandson, I think we all have that stuff inside. And just because we have smartphones and we can text and do that, I think we're still the same.
I want to talk about that, the next book now, that book, Forever. You can only whisper the title, Forever. The YA author Juno Dawson once wrote that no novel since Forever has tackled virginity quite so comprehensively for young adults.
Why? But you know what?
What do you think of that? No, tell me. Break in.
No, finish. You were going to say something.
Well,
why?
I want to know why. I want to know why. I mean, that author said that YA authors still write sex off the page a lot. And it's still a bit of a taboo. And I want to know why it's so hard to write sex, especially teenage sex.
Well, let's start with number one. There was no such thing as YA when I wrote that book.
Absolutely.
Okay, so my publishers didn't know what to do with it. Yeah. And they called it my first book for adults, which I almost killed them for doing that because it wasn't. But there wasn't, you know, a category for it. And Forever is not my favorite of my books. Wow. It's okay. But I wrote it specifically, really, and not the best reason to write a book, but my daughter was 14 and she was reading a lot of books. You know, if a girl succumbed to this and did this terrible thing, she was going to be punished. She was going to get pregnant. The boy was going to leave her. She was going to be shipped off to Aunt Betty's house somewhere to a clinic, I don't know, to a girl's home. And there was never sex without punishment. And my daughter at 14, she is now 60, she said to me, Mom, couldn't there ever be a book where two nice kids do it and nothing bad happens? And I thought, well, there should be that book. And so I wrote Forever.
Why isn't it one of your favorites?
No reason. I don't know. You know, I have maybe my favorites are more autobiographical. I'm not sure. Forever certainly is not.
It's certainly one of your most banned books. I've got a statement from a school in Iowa that banned this, and the reason given was that it does not promote abstinence and monogamous relationships and lacks any aesthetic, literary, or social value. How does it feel to have your book characterized like that? Does that enrage you?
Well, you know, there was a terrible time in the 80s when the censors really came after me. Those who wanted to censor books. Really came after me. They have other targets now. I'm not so much a target. They have new targets. Anything to do with, and never get the initials right, LBGT.
Yes.
What comes after.
We know
after.
What you mean. Yeah.
Okay, so they have new targets. They have that target. They have racism, anything to do with racism and trying to, you know, get kids talking about it, that's become very taboo.
And how is it? How is it organized? How does that roll out? Like, who's behind these campaigns?
You know, they are organized groups, I guess. Yeah. They communicate with one another easily now, and it's, you know, this is what they do. And most schools have policies in place, so you can't just have a book removed. You have to go through what you should have to go through, you know, a, a committee if a book is challenged. And I hope that most of them are not removed. You just don't know.
Of course, at one point you were up there with Stephen King for the most banned author. And it was interestingly your book starring girls, so Deanie, Blubber, Forever, Margaret, Tiger Eyes, all ended up in the censor's crosshairs. How much do you think that had to do with the fact that these were female voices?
Well, I know that when it comes to Deanie, I mean, there was a time when Deanie was so banned or not purchased in the first place because of masturbation. I mean, there was a time when kids didn't even know I had written a book called Deanie. And definitely, I mean, even with Forever, it was a female being sexually satisfied that really drove people crazy. Like, no, girls can't do that. No. And I mean, I even had a principal say to me, well, you know, if it was about a boy, that would be normal. Mm. But about a girl, no. But I think, you know, we have come a ways. I won't say a long way, but we have moved on a bit from that. Masturbation is probably still a big no-no, which is a shame because it's so good. You know what? It's the safest sex. You want your kids to practice safe sex? Let them masturbate. Of course, they're not asking, Mom, hey, Mom, can I go masturbate now? But, you know, be happy that they have found this.
And similarly, Forever. Forever is, you know, it was so controversial. I remember, like, folding down different pages and then reading it aloud to my friends, and I remember my mum somehow surprising us and coming up from behind, and I flung the book. We're outside in the backyard. I threw the book into the bushes. And this idea, it wasn't just the content, but it was this idea that this book was banned or it was hard to obtain. But really, it does seem innocent by today's standards when parents are not only having to teach their kids about sex, they have to teach them about porn in the event that they might stumble across it on the internet. We have to have very early...
And they will.
Yes, absolutely. In some ways, Forever reads like a handbook for a consensual safe sex relationship.
Yeah, everything is so different. That there is a huge difference, you know, not just safe sex, but consensual sex. And, you know, I think it would be very hard to be talking about all of this with your kids. And I'm kind of glad mine are grown up.
Yeah, that is interesting to hear that from you, because you do portray these worlds of tweens and teens and kids so beautifully, but... And even though you say that everyone is sort of the same inside, do you look at their world now and think it's a lot more, the stuff they have to navigate is more complicated?
Yeah. Yeah. Much, much. And I'll tell you, I mean, Margaret, for instance, when Margaret was published, the reader was 12 years old, the average reader, I would say, that I used to hear from. They were 12 years old. Maybe 11, 12, maybe 13. But today kids are reading it at 9 and 10. And I think that's fine. I don't think that they will get the same thing out of it. And so I always hope that maybe they'll pick it up again when they are just that age. But, you know, I'm not going to say don't read it at 9 years old. If you're interested and you are going to ask questions, of your mom or your sister or somebody, that's okay. I just don't think the feelings are the same. But it's, you know, yes, things have changed. And I mean, Forever seems to me today so incredibly simplistic. That, and maybe that's why it's not my favorite. You know, it's...
And yet still, it is remarkably revolutionary for the fact that it is... from a female-centered perspective, and it is about her pleasure and seeking pleasure unapologetically. So it's pretty extraordinary. In terms of, I want to talk a little bit about your most recent book and your book for adults, In the Unlikely Event, which was your first adult book in 17 years. So it's set in the 50s, which is the decade of your teenage years, of course, and I've heard you say that you hated the 50s. The 50s bored you to tears.
Until I started going back and writing this book. This book is, all the characters are fictional, but it is very autobiographical in that this was my town. These events were happening in my town. And while I am not any of those characters, this is the book that I feel I was born to write. I just feel, how is it possible as a writer for, at that time, like 40-something years, that I had this story, I knew this story, and I never thought of writing it until I heard another writer on stage.
And just to be clear, it centers around three freak plane crashes that actually happened in your hometown in the space of how long?
50-something days, maybe. Yeah. 50-something days. There was December, January, February. It was crazy. And, of course, we all knew about it. But, you know, it wasn't on TV. It wasn't covered. We didn't have that kind of news that covered everything the way it would today. So we didn't actually see it, although some of my friends did go to the sites and see it. I didn't. I don't know why my mother didn't let me. Well, why didn't I go anyway? You know, I don't know. But I didn't actually see it for myself. But reading about it in the old newspapers, the newspapers covered it with incredible detail. And I was back there in the 50s, and I love this book. This is embarrassing to say this, but I'm so proud of it. I guess that's the thing. And feeling that, you know, 5 years, a long time to work on a book. I love the research. Love doing the research. And I said to my husband, I said, I'm never doing another book without research. This is so cool. Why haven't I done this before? You know, why did I just have to make it all up when research is fabulous? And I loved that. And I just feel now that this is the book that brings it all together for me. It will be my last novel. I'm not writing another long book. I don't want to be locked up for 5 years.
Are we to blame the fact that you are now running a bookshop and you love that too much? Is that what is keeping you from your writing, Judy?
Well, I think I said to myself, 50 years, I've written for 50 years. That's good. That's enough. And it was kind of simultaneous. At the same time, this wonderful opportunity came where, you know, we could have a bookshop. And it's like, I was also born to do this. Yes. I love being in the bookshop. I love moving the books around and, you know, if not sniffing them, touching them, petting them. I call it petting my books every day. And it's very exciting. It's extremely hard. I never knew how hard work it would be and exhausting, but very satisfying. And it's also creative. There's something very creative about it. I don't know if I can even explain that, but I am happy. And I was isolated during this time of COVID for a full year with a writing project that I wanted to do. And I never did it.
Wow, telling. No excuses.
No. I don't know why.
Is it true, Judy, that you have staff picks in your bookshop and you sign off as Judy B?
Yes, we do. I do. And you know what? they disappear often. They disappear, these little staff rec cards. And I know now that I should take a picture because I can never write the same thing again, you know? So, yes, yes, don't let that get around that you can go there and take my little staff rec card.
We'll keep that quiet. Okay, we have a question down here at the front.
How did writing your books affect the lives of your children?
Well, probably you would have to ask them that. I always tried very hard, I think too hard, to not affect their lives in any way, to just be, you know, one of the moms on the street. I was always home because I was, and I think I didn't let them see me working. I think I didn't let them know how hard it was. And I'm sorry now that I didn't. But that was in a foolish quest that they shouldn't be affected. I mean, of course, eventually people did say, oh, you know, your mom wrote those books, but my daughter tells a story. She was on a plane once and she was next to a small girl who was reading one of my books. And she said, you know, my mother wrote that book. And the little girl said, no, she didn't. And Randy had to argue and say, yes, she did. And then she said, well, and asked her a question like, you know, well, what's her daughter's name? Of course, it was my daughter. And she got a kick out of it. I think when they got older, they appreciated it more. And certainly today, they definitely, as grown-ups, I think they really do appreciate it.
Especially given they have very seminal books dedicated to them. I think you dedicated Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing to Larry, your son, because he was a combination of both Fudge and Peter. So that's very cool. I have another question here from Tasmania, actually, the Terra Australis Festival in southern Tasmania. How do you ensure the technical or scientific information in your books remains up to date from generation to generation?
We don't change. Well, you know, I say that. I don't believe in changing things. I did change the pad in Margaret, the period pad, because right after I published the book, belts became obsolete and period pads had little sticky things on them to stick to your panties. And I did, you know, the Fudge books were written over many, many, many years, like, I don't know, 20 years or something. And electronics did change. And at one point, I did have to do a little fussing with them. I did it myself. And I'm not sure that I should have. I don't think we should, you know, change books.
Is the Margaret movie set in the 70s?
1970.
It is.
Yeah.
Interesting. Very cool. I have another question over here in person.
Hi, Judy. You've talked about children's inner lives and how I think all of us would feel you have so profoundly affected our inner lives. And I was wondering if you think children are naturally drawn to reading, because we notice that in this generation, children are reading less. We've talked about electronics, and as a parent and a primary school teacher, do you have any insights on how we might encourage children in this generation to love reading as much as we did?
I wish. I don't know. I think, again, finding the right book for the right child at the right time is what it's all about. And I watch them at the bookstore. It is not easy. And so many of them don't know how to choose a book. They don't know, you know, read the first page, read a middle page, see if you like what we would call the voice. But they don't know that. And that's too bad. I would like to, you know, give a class on choosing books. But then there are other kids who come in and they sit on the floor and they know exactly what they want and they don't want anybody's help. And when the YAs come in, they definitely don't want anybody's help. They want to find the book on their own. So it's interesting. Yeah, I just don't know. I don't know. They have to know how to read because they're going to want to read on their electronic devices. So they need to be able to read. Maybe listening.
I know that you always said that you treasured the fact that your parents gave you the freedom to choose what you read. How important do you think that is for a kid?
I think it was very important. I mean, it was very important. I would have found books anyway, but it was very important to me that we had a lot of books in the house. We had bookcases in the house. And by the time I was 12, I wasn't interested in what was available for me, and I was a reader. You know, we didn't have YA books then, and I was interested in life and grown-ups and what it would be like to be a grown-up. And so I found fabulous books on their bookshelves, and they never questioned what I was reading, never, because reading was a good thing. I don't know, my mother was afraid of everything, but she was a reader. She was a reader, and I don't think she was ever afraid of me reading books. I think that was always seen as a good thing.
Well, we have your mother to thank for fostering that love of reading and then making sure that you produced the amazing books that are so special to so many of us. Thank you so much for talking to us tonight, Judy. I know it's like nearly 11 o'clock there for you now, so you've got to get to the store tomorrow. So I think you should get into your pajamas now.
That was so long ago. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you. Everyone, please join me in thanking Judy Bloom.
Thank you. It was lovely. I wish I had another hour with you.
Same. I think we all wish that.
Come to PS.
Okay.
And we'll talk. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.